Now that you're here, we're all in the company of your cool aunts. I'm Sam.
And I'm Ted.
And this is the Your Cool Aunts podcast, where we follow the lives and times of cool aunts through Claire's diary. So welcome back. Or if you're new here, hop on over to our website, where you'll find all of Claire's diary entries and her photos and our backstory, too. So check it out.
Check it out. Don't forget, we're on Instagram and Twitter.
And every platform where you listen to your podcast. So like us, follow us, and never miss a thing.
Hi, everybody.
Hi, everybody.
It's a wave. I'm waving.
A virtual wave. There's
a virtual
sound to
wave.
A virtual wave.
Sure. So what do we have today?
We are, it's Claire's latest new thing, being this series that she is calling Love, War, Champagne. And this is another episode in that series, I guess it's fair to say. We've been in the coves of Champagne during World War II, reading in the diary of an almost 20-something young woman who seems to have fallen in love with an American soldier.
Well, she didn't say that she fell in love. She was hinting at that. But we
don't
know
like,
who she is.
The ingredients are there.
You know, I just want to go back a little for a little moment and say, I remember when we met Claire in France, and she was very hesitant about, oh, I don't know if I want to do this, and a podcast was born. Now she's giving us different information. So I guess she must be getting into it as well.
She's getting more comfortable with the sharing aspect, I think.
Yeah.
Well, you can't dive into the deep end. I think there's a lot to look at, and she's wading in.
But this is a totally different angle. I didn't expect this, but here we go.
Well, I don't think she did either. Well, Laurent has recruited her into it.
That's true.
She gave her a diary to write in herself, tell her she's part of a diary legacy in the Women of Champagne. And it turns out there was a lot more meaning to that when Laurent originally said it to Claire.
Yep.
And Claire is turning the pages or peeling back the layers, whatever metaphor you choose, and finding another woman who came before her. And she really wants to know who it is.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, so here we are.
Without further ado.
Claire's note. Nieces, aunts, and friends. Well, here's the third in a series from the old diaries I've been reading and sharing with you. I'm developing a theory about whose diary this could have been. Laurent tends to wave me off when I ask any more than a few questions about the author. I think she may have a good idea who the writer is or was. Anyway, this entry gives us a very intense or up-close sense of what it was like living in the coves during the war. She does a P.S. and a by the way. Everyone, and I mean everyone, who knows, pronounces C-A-V-E as cov, and she spells it C-A-H-V, with a short A sound, and definitely never ever cave with a long A sound, as in where Neanderthal people had lived.
Well,
it's just a funny little thing she worked out there. It is true. When you say cov, sometimes I think people who don't know think it might be a wee bit pretentious, but it's not a cave. It's a cov.
Right. It's a cov.
When there's champagne in it, it's a cov.
It's the same thing as anglicizing Reims, R-E-I-M-S, city, and it's Reims, which is the proper way to say it. But people say Reims all the time.
Yeah. So all that to say, it's Reims and cov in the world of champagne. And from those people who know, this diary entry, and it's another from this writer, we don't know who she is, and this one has a title that says, My American. And let's recall that this is a translation that Claire has done, and I'm sure Claire has been very faithful to the translation. I don't think she's bringing any more to it than it's what the writer intended. But what do I know, you know? My American. And the writer says, October seemed so long ago when I worried about stockpiling enough flour to make a few loaves every week, again, just enough to give everyone a little bit every other day or so. And then there's the lost bread everyone seems to crave and wish for. Their family recipes and habits, but we have none. There's never anything left over. We eat whatever we do have, and it's really never quite enough. And as such, the idea of something left over is but a dream from the past or towards the future. But here I am, with more paper and ink than I could have wished for, a tall American look for me when they returned to the Cove at Christmas that night. I think he might have found an extra supply of ink and paper for me specifically, because believe it or not, I had shared my diary with him late one night. I let him see it mostly because I hadn't been writing in it for more than a month. It felt safe. It seemed so long ago that I felt sort of disembodied from it in time. Let me interrupt here. You know, my guess as she's writing this is maybe she felt like it really didn't matter. I mean, they were in such a dire circumstance, like, here, fine, read this.
But to share your diary with somebody,
I know,
it's more than just a, let me give you some background information of what this place operates. You know what I mean?
Well, I think it might be more personal than that.
Well, yeah, that's what I was saying. She's not just giving it to him like it's a, you know.
No, I think she's falling in love with him.
Yeah, I think she is too.
So, running out of space to write on and always conserving my remaining ink by writing in superfine script and writing two lines of text where there is normally only one, and space and ink eventually ran out. But it is amazing what you can find or substitute when things grow scarce. In my American, he probably thought I was odd, but once he had read some of my diary, he started to seem to understand more about us and me. Aha, so I do think it's getting more personal.
Yes, I think so.
Okay. Any other thoughts?
I thought it was getting personal. I just didn't realize it was getting so personal.
It's warming up in the Cobs. When things grow scarce. This is what we talked about for hours. We had formed a friendship in part over his need to improve his basic French. And for me, my English was only slightly better. I think we developed a deeper understanding of one another. And he was so interested in our village, especially before this war. And he was curious about how we figured out how to make things so well and so much better, especially when we had almost nothing to work with. And exasperated, late one night, he wondered aloud if we might be better at everything in a crisis. Hmm. You know, there is some truth to that. You get very creative. You know, for example, and I don't mean to belittle their experience, they're surviving in a cove during war and all that, but my comparison is in the kitchen. When you have very limited, you know, maybe you come in late one night after a trip or something and there's almost nothing in the house. You have some pasta and a knob of butter that, you know, you can whip up something. The best soup in the world is when you do the bits and parts left over in the refrigerator and you make a wonderful stock and, right?
Yeah.
A lack of supplies really drives us, drives our creativity to try this. Why not? You know?
Yeah. See, what I'm thinking about when she mentioned not having enough ink and paper was how we take that for granted. You'll always have paper and ink. You'll always have a pen. You'll always be able to write. But what happens if you didn't have that? Or you had very limited supplies. What do you do with that? And it's, I was just thinking, it'd be so frustrating to want to do something and not be able to have the resource to do it. As something as simple as a piece of paper and a pen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And how much more you appreciate it when you do get it.
I think the American's observation is apt. Are you guys actually better at things when you're in crisis, you know? I think she goes on to some, I'm going to stop my comment because I can see ahead. I'm about to touch into what she's written here. And she writes, something to read. It started with the history of Champagne, and still desperate for something more to read, I loaned him our village, and she puts air quotes around library, which consisted of only about 12 volumes of mostly handwritten pages documenting the ups and downs of the last 100 years or so. It lived in an old apple crate for the last few years, and it readily showed that wear and tear. He'd sit for hours with his little translation dictionary, reading by any little stub of a candle. It really was all we had as a village, a registry of births and deaths, loose and random pages on the vineyards and land grants. And then there were the diaries, collected and saved, that told the stories of the people who had somehow survived the bombings and upheaval of the last war, the war that was supposed to be the end of all wars. He whipped through them in just a few weeks, constantly returning to me with questions. And every answer of mine generated more questions from him. He had a deep desire to understand the why of this place, my village. He asked and repeated time and again that he wanted to know what it was about this place that made us survive disaster after war after war. Why or how did we manage to be so resilient and so determined? And we spoke to one another in our fourth grade versions of French and English over the table while we prepped food for the day ahead. I was unable to answer at least half of his questions, but I was happy to tell the stories that I did know firsthand. And there was some invention on my part from time to time, too.
She's a storyteller. Let me
put her diary on hold and say, no, these people are falling in love. will talk about anything, any source of conversation, but to be in conversation. And imagine how difficult it was to do this.
That's what I was getting ready to say.
Earshot view of the village. Or I'm sure people sort of migrated to their little personal corners here and there, but you're in a cov with other people.
Well, I think two things. That comment about not having privacy, or the other concern about the language barrier. You know, she says, what, fourth grade, maybe, you know? Yeah. And so you're trying to have a conversation with somebody. It's not like you're asking them how to directions or anything. I mean, they're becoming mm-hmm. intimate with each other, or so we think, and having to bridge that.
Yeah. I think that there's a lot of hand gestures and pantomime and, you know,
pictures.
Those things you fill in. But why, she says. I explain as best I could that we make the most challenging wines on the edges of a climate that doesn't want to cooperate with neighbors who want to take our land and our ways from us. Hmm. And that's her statement about, why do you do this? Why are you so determined? So why do you do this? And when you think about it, they do. They make the most delicate wine in the most challenging places. So
I was just going to say, when you think about what they have survived, they've survived pestilence, they've survived mm-hmm. the weather, they've survived people invading mm-hmm. them, and still they survive.
It's not going to surprise you when I read the next few lines. I know you don't have it in front of you, but she says, we survived the repeated attacks from the north and the east and up from the earth in the form of pestilence, too. And on one difficult night, he looked over the last lighted candle, asking me, how did we get up and face it day after day and year after year? Why don't we just move south? And I know she's going to say, you know, this is our, you know, what? So she says, this is the exact moment when I realized that if anyone besides a local were to ever understand this place, I needed to find a way to explain the Champenoise and what exactly makes us tick. I explained to him that the people here would never, ever leave. We're of this place. We've always managed to return to what it is that we alone have created, and that it continues to serve us well. When this war ends, I said we will plow and level the now cratered vineyards to replant and start over for the next season. There is always a next season, and we will find an improved vine stock and agree that we will work to improve any element or place that is lacking. Otherwise, why bother? And she says, in so doing, we will always be able to answer with pride when our grandchildren ask what we did to win the war, improve the wine, or grow our family. A little bit more. Let me read it. We will simply say that we did everything we could with everything we had, and when there was little or none, we found something else and a better way. And I believe I was on my way to conveying the most subtle notion we live by here in the North. It's the terroir.
There goes that word again.
Oh,
it's the
God.
Terroir. You know, I just want to go back to scarcity for a moment. I was thinking about when Laurent visited, I think it was in the Lost Bread episode, and taking a few pieces, slices of bread, and cutting them and buttering them and just making them perfect on the plate. Mm-hmm. And how, and it gets back to the detail thing, even with a couple of pieces of bread, you can make something so much more than what they are.
Well,
that's
not,
how
not
they
just
are about
look,
scarcity.
But the experience, the entirety of the experience is
right.
incorporated into the moment.
Right. And that's what she's basically talking about. Why bother if you're not going to make it the best that you can make it?
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So details matter, right?
Yeah, I'm sure she's going to go. I'm sure she's going to visit that theory again. So I shall continue. And she says, he really was like us. After that night, he only ever called me the professor. His job for the group was to procure and prepare enough food to feed 8 men every day. And he was becoming more like us, the Champagne was, in the way that he was so determined to make things work. No one doubted he would be successful every day. His determination brought with it a state of trust and calm, too. Truthfully, he worried every day until the food was handed out and then began again for the next round. Let me step out of reading for a second. I think this was her role as well. And we don't have her name, so I'm just...
Her name's Professor. That's what he calls her.
Oh, right.
He calls her the Professor.
She just said that. I think they both had the same role, that they were kind of leading each of their groups.
Responsibility.
Yeah. So, okay, I'll go on. Watching him read one night, I remarked that he was growing into a role not unlike ours, and that maybe he was beginning to get it, as he always exclaimed in his uniquely American way. Only days later, we were coordinating our efforts to feed everyone living in the Cove together. Neither of us had enough to make decent food for our separate groups, but combined, we were able to produce at least one exceptionally good meal every day. And the mood of the place changed quickly. Energy levels jumped, and soon we were planning and looking for what else we could do together. And a few of the older kids ventured out for truffles and chanterelles. We ate well in those weeks, when he said every night at dinner, "Well, it looks like we have plenty of great wine on hand."
That sounds like something an American would say, waving his hand back at the... kilometers of champagne in the cobs, right?
And then everything changed. And she writes, Germans took a firmer hold of the region when we were surrounded and the Americans were cut off from their base. We, the villagers, that is, all agreed it was time to introduce them to our little underground resistance movement. Yes, the resistance. After all this time living in the Cove together, they never suspected what we had been up to. By coordinating one of the busiest outposts of the resistance undetected and alongside these men, we proved to ourselves that we might be pretty good at this after all. And just like how we worked together feeding all of these people, we agreed that working together on everything would improve all of our chances. We quickly hid every trace of their uniforms into a wall void and dressed them as farmers. And after a crash course in basic French, and a few acting classes and incomprehensible shrugging, we assured ourselves that maybe, and with a little luck, we could pass them off as typically French, should anyone stumble upon our little outpost Cove.
Wow, talk about taking a turn. So now the Americans are
I think the American knew. I think the American knew. He kept pressing her for details. What is it about you people? What makes you tick? Why are you like this? Or maybe he just had a sense. I don't know.
Do you think
they might be up to something?
Oh, I was thinking
like
of the Germans
suspected,
taking over.
Like, what do you really do? You know, what? I don't know. Maybe it's just
Well, I guess the idea of being in a Cove for months, you know, years probably, and having a whole city down there, a little town of people.
They couldn't trust anyone.
They couldn't trust anybody.
And often they couldn't trust other French people. You know,
right.
They were...
Because you never knew what side somebody was on.
Is one more section. Shall we go on?
Sure. I feel like the spy who came in from the cold.
This will make you laugh when you hear the next little title. It's in the details. It's always in the details. It's the terroir. It's the diary.
Yeah.
It's in the details, she writes. Our success would be founded in staying out of the way and looking like we were moving along in an ordinary day. In an ordinary field, possibly waiting for an extraordinary night drop, and not necessarily hiding, doing what we do normally, just farmers in their fields. So, my dear reader, if you ask me how we made it through the war, I hope this gives you a little idea about what we did when the Germans came for us again. And this happens to be when I learned something about love, too. We were warned to never, ever get involved with a soldier, unless, of course, it was for the resistance. My feelings for the American definitely do not fall into that category. He's just such a nice guy. It wasn't at all hard for me to imagine being with him in peacetime, but for now, I'll take each day as it comes and write about it in my diary and continue doing what we do in this little French village in Champagne.
That's it.
C'est tout.
I thought she was going to tell us more. I say that every time I read. Every time you read that, I think, there's got to be more to it than that. Maybe there is.
Maybe I should have a better way of signaling that the end is nigh.
The end is coming. Oh, that's so good. So he's the American and she's the professor.
Love,
that's all
war,
we know.
Champagne. We have all three now.
Yes, we do.
Love, war, champagne. Gee, Claire.
So they're going to teach them how to look like farmers and kind of speak French, but shrug when they need to.
You know, they'll just do the grunting, you know, like a coarse farmer would be, and just, you know, try to move along from discovery or anything, just scuff along in the fields. And
well, wow. Claire must be intrigued. I mean,
intrigued. It's
been so interesting listening to her diary, and now to get this one.
Well, we've only ever
from somewhere.
We've only someone. Ever experienced Claire's diary. You know, as the hosts of this podcast. And now where this is Claire's diary about the diary of another woman that she's reading and their common experience. We don't know what she knows.
Well,
Claire has never left us hanging for too long. So I look forward to more Claire. We know we have initials to work with. We have a B and an L. He calls her the professor. She's almost 20. He's an American soldier. What else do we know?
Her grandparents are down there with her. Gosh, I really like this one.
Hey, you know what? Don't forget, Claire has invited us all to send us thoughts or comments.
That's right.
And she shared her email address, which is also on the website, but it's clairejulliot@protonmail.com, which is clairejulliot@protonmail.com. Tell her what you think.
Well, I'm going to tell her I want to hear more. I'd like to know more about these people.
Patience. We want more. So let's keep it all going. Keep this conversation going. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram, wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Sam.
And I'm Ted.
And we'll see you next time when we're
back at the mic.